This afternoon, we have three main things I want to cover. It's called GIS in Society as a general topic. First, we're going to start off sharing with you a person who I've known for seems like my whole life. He expresses for me leadership in GIS. And then we'll talk about education, we'll talk about conservation, and listen to our keynote. But this person is a person who, like Roger Tomlinson, who originally invented GIS, was early into its development. He invented the dime file at the U.S. Census Bureau. Don Cook was a person who I always looked up to. Well, I always looked up to Roger, too, and still do, Roger. I really do. He's taller than me, for example. But Don is another such person. Each year we choose someone from our community who exemplifies leadership, and in this case, lifetime achievement. Don Cook, as a student, an undergraduate student in Yale University, started working part-time for the Census Bureau in 1967 or something like that. I'm not quite sure. He became interested in the census, and in 1968, he co-developed something called the dime file. The dime file was the first street network file with topology. We think of him as the author of what we currently call tiger files or street network files. And this invention led to many subsequent activities. Don is a person who is, of course, creative, sometimes fun. He wrote a book called Fun with GPS. Some of you have seen it and actually probably have it. He started also in an entrepreneurial adventure, starting map data collection companies. And in 1968, he told me a little vision. Come here, Don. He said, you know what I'm going to do, Jack, is I'm going to get all the street files for the whole bloody country together. Remember that?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, cool.
And so he started GDT with one of his colleagues, which later became TeleAtlas, now used as a kind of standard street file for the world. He's that kind of guy. He invents things, and he also has fun. Please join me in welcoming and honoring this lifetime achievement person, Don Cook. He's my friend.
Thank you. Wow. Wow. Thanks, Jack. This is such an unbelievable honor. It's really great. I feel very lucky, and I hope all of you get a chance to be as lucky as I have in my lifetime. I don't mean the kind of luck where you win the lottery. I'm talking about the real kind of luck, and luck really is the coincidence, the confluence of preparation and opportunity. And this is a very lucky place. I mean, if you want preparation, go to the sessions, go to the workshops there. You want opportunity, meet people that are your kindred souls in your area there, and you'll be making connections that you have no idea in the future how they're going to change your life. So enjoy a very lucky, wonderful place here. So lifetime achievement, wow, it's really great. But as my friend Mike Goodchild said when he was up here a couple of years ago receiving the same award, he said, yeah, lifetime, but you know what? I'm not done. You know, you kind of get this feeling that lifetime achievement is really wonderful. But on the other hand, you know, you think the people from the Wax Museum are, are right behind. So, moving right along there, I'm going to try to do three things here in 13 minutes and 24 seconds. One is to talk to you about what happened 40 years ago that Bill Maxfield and I worked on at the New Haven Census Use Study, the dual independent map encoding system. That was 40 years ago this month. And then kind of life after dime, and I really want to see if I can close up with two quick glimpses into the future. So thinking of opportunity and preparation, my preparation for the job at the Census Use Study, who started in 1967, was in the Army in the early 60s. I was a surveyor, I was an instrument operator, and I was a computer. I was a computer. Let me show you some of my output from 1963. I looked up logarithms for 3 years in the Army, in Korea and Germany, and computer surveys, and that's how you did it in those days. But when I was discharged from the Army, I was replaced by a FADAC, F-A-D-A-C computer, which weighed more than I did and could actually do 375 divisions every second, and it did my Army career in about 20 seconds or so. Let me tell you about what Bill and I were given in 1967. We were told that the Census Bureau Address Coding Guide was an ideal structure for doing computer mapping. All we had to do is kind of sprinkle latitudes and longitudes into it here and there. And this is a little nerdy, but I am going to show you basically what this meant. Here's an address coding guide for a section of a census map there. And it's the logical unit is a range of addresses. Here's the 100 block, the odd numbers for Denver Street in block number 913. Here's the next address coding guide record, which now spans 300 addresses, and then here's another one, this another 100, and so forth like that. And then on the other side of the street, you got this one great big long block face there. And boy, there's a lot of details I'd love to tell you about, and you would just totally eat it up, except, you know what, I'm gonna cut it short and say, this was not using an address range as a logical unit for computer mapping was a loser. So what did Bill and I do? We did something very simple and very obvious, which is that if we're going to talk about objects in space, we had to be able to name them. And we could name blocks because they had census three-digit block numbers on them, which you can see on the map there. What was missing, though, were little node numbers, you know, so we could unequivocally talk about, you know, node number 197, you know. And so the very first thing we really found we had to do was we just had to put numbers out there in the world at every single intersection, everywhere a road bent. And if you get the numbers there, something magic happens to the lines, which is that you can define a straight line as being the line between from one node to another node. And if you stand at one node, look at the other node, then you find you have one block on the left and one block on the right. And this is dual independent map encoding. This meant now we had two address ranges in each segment, and I've left them off this example. But yeah, we did encode the addresses. Also, let me just show you what that looks like. You know, here's a line segment in Denver Street there from 190 something, 196 to 197, then one from 197 to 198. You can see the left right coding 201 on the left, 202 on the right, and so forth. Now, something very neat happens if you get this left right encoding. You know, for example, let's say I need to operate on the boundary of block 202. Well, all I have to do is systematically select all blocks where you have block 202 occurring either in the left field or on the right field, but not both, you know, and that defines a boundary segment. And why would you want to do that? Well, let me show you why. Because you got to remember, these numbers are written by fallible human beings onto maps and then by other fallible human beings on coding forms, and which are then punched onto punch cards by another fallible human being. And what happens to us humans is we make mistakes. And the neat thing about this encoding was that you could grab all the segments on the boundary of a block and chain them together on the node numbers. And in this case, we couldn't complete the chain. Why? Because someone had typed in 602 instead of 206 there. So what Bill Maxfield and I would do is we'd pull that punch card out and duplicate up to that point, repunch it, put it back in the deck, rerun the edit. Usually 30% of the blocks would fail the first pass, and you'd iterate through that a few times, and you get zero defects. So our first dime file was small. I mean, it was a city of New Haven, it was 4,000 punch cards, two boxes of cards. But the fact that we could systematically eliminate all of certain classes of errors from the encoding of the file made it pretty clear to us, even back in 1967, that this process was scalable, that you could go nationwide with this. And so that sort of, you know, sunk into our backgrounds. And, you know, so we did things like we wrote comic books about a dime and address matching. And then in 1968, Jack Sweeney, who wrote the Ad Match program, and Bill Maxfield and I formed Urban Data Processing, and ended my first chapter working with the Census Bureau. So dime was maybe 10 years ahead of its time or so. So basically what happened is my wife Jennifer is in the front row here, and I joined the Back to the Land movement and built a house off the grid in Vermont, and I mean built, like mixed cement and so forth, and brought our first two children home to this. There's my son Dylan, aged probably a week or so, with Jenny on the right-hand side there in the cellar hole of what was to be our house. Dylan did not turn out to be a geographer. He is a mapper, though. He happens to map neurons in brains. He's doing a postdoc at UC Davis now, married to a wonderful Princeton classmate there. So, and he knows how to run a GPS. In 1980, Hart Hanks bought Urban Data Processing, and Jenny and I still own 15% of the stock, and wow, we suddenly had money. We looked at each other and said, can we stop living in the woods, buy a real house with electricity? And I said, yeah, but I also want to buy a computer. And so I bought a Data General S140 and started writing code that had been in the back of my mind. This is a $75,000 computer that's about as powerful as your digital wristwatch now. But fundamentally, you know, the idea was no more punch cards. We can actually interact with the digital map. I really got to move along there. The only way we realized that the idea of a nationwide map was through the Census Bureau building Tiger out of dime, and GDT was one of the major contractors in doing that. We built the Dynamap product, which had improved geocoding based on Tiger, though, and formed this wonderful, our best and favorite partnership with ESRI. Now, I talked to Jack about what was I going to say when I got up here, and he said, well, say about GDT, you were one of the first, or maybe the first company that thought of geodata as a product, as something commoditizable. And I said, yeah, okay, that might be true. But what I really think we did was we established the fact that it was possible for a private company to compete against a free public domain database in a way that is exquisitely reinforcing both what the Census Bureau does and what we do in the most positive way. I really think we do geodata right in the U.S. with this public domain ethic that we have. Jack also says, tell these people out here what your passions are, what you're interested in. I said, Jack, you sure you want that? And he said, yep. So, okay, here goes. I got one picture here, which has got four of my passions. One is a Sirius telescope there for asteroid occultation timing there. My 1959 AC sports car with my windsurfer hanging over it, and then one of Jenny and my garden carts. We were both avid gardeners there. I don't have a picture to show you of my piano quartet where I play cello in, or me playing ice hockey. I do have one of my astro photos and a picture of Jenny in our other toy car in a cemetery. More about that later. But the thing that really I'm still just totally entranced with this GIS and GPS technology that's coming out now. And GPS is really, you know, quite wonderful. My daughter Abby took me to Thailand a year ago to a wedding, and of course I brought my GPS along, so I knew that Fairbanks, Alaska was coming up on the way to Thailand. We went to this wedding way up near the Laotian border there and got on a bus on the way home, and oh, bummer, the bus got hit by a truck and tipped over, but never fear, the GPS was running so I could map where we were in Google Earth and then bring the GPS points into ArcView and compute exactly how fast the bus was going at the time, and that Abby and I spent 2 minutes and 10 seconds inside the bus before we walked out through the broken windshield there. I take GPSs everywhere. I've logged about GPS about 200,000 miles commercial flying. Here are my flights for the last 18 months. And I got entranced with this idea of attaching GPS to things that move around outdoors, and took this idea to Jack and Laura Dangerman and the people at ESRI Press, and they were totally wonderful about this, and they supported a book called Fun with GPS, and I really want a lot of people to help me with this book. For example, my daughter Abby, who's also here in the front row. And here's Abby helping me map the Dartmouth sailing team that she used to race against when she was on the Yale sailing team there. And here's a map that we made out of that. And I'm very proud to say that Abby has just finished her first year in a PhD program at UCLA in geography. And of course, Fun with GPS established the first feline GPS superstar. You know, which is Mary the cat, who's got a great fan following. There, here's Mary's map, and here's Mary with my daughter Emma, and Emma has got a master's degree in landscape design and mastered ARC 9.1 along the way with that. Emma's at home taking care of the cats right now. Okay, almost done. Two views of the future. The first one is driven by personal navigation. Remember the ETAC company 24 years ago came out with this wonderful device. ETAC, incidentally, is part of TeleAtlas now. And you all look at that map on the display screen. This is before GPS. And you see a normal top-down map. Today's PNAVs, like this TomTom with TeleAtlas data in it, there gives us kind of this 2.5 degree it's 3D. It's not 3D, it's not 2D, it's sort of halfway in between there. But here's what's happening in Japan. You know, when you get route guidance on your cell phone in Japan, you're seeing it in a 3D immersive environment there. So this is pictures I took of our process for building 3D virtual worlds at TeleAtlas. Munich, Germany, 3D models. It's pretty neat stuff. I've been obsessed with this for the last 8 months. I just love this technology. There's Jack and me in front of this van. Look at all the gadgets in the van. We got one of them in the booth. Come look at it in the exhibit area there. I'm going to skip over that slide. You know, it's just gadgetry. I love this stuff. It's just so great there. I need to tell you about a fantasy world. This is Linden. I had it's our second life. I had a Dartmouth junior geography major intern this winter. I said, go buy something real in Linden. So she took her avatar, and think of an avatar as sort of a computerized marionette, into a store, picked out a t-shirt, and lo and behold, here's real commerce in a fantasy world with Louisa McCarthy and Louisa Barracuda, the avatar, wearing the same t-shirt. And this, I think, is very important because now you can link a fantasy world to a real world, and instead of walk into a fantasy store, it could be a real one there. This is a change in the paradigm of how we do commerce from a catalog one to a virtual reality one. That's a Circuit City store in Linden. 3D maps are eye grabbers that will steal attention from everything else. There's no going back to simple maps. Keep your eye on 3D. I'm just about done. One more view of the future, and this is our children, our students there. They love this technology. They're good at it. They can do a GPS treasure hunt, find an abstract latitude and longitude just looking at the numbers there. They love it. They can write their name on the face of the earth with a GPS. But what I really love is giving GPSs to 20 seventh graders and then have them make a map for the facilities committee of their school grounds, or give digital cameras and a Stradivarius GPS to fourth graders and have them inventory and map a historic cemetery. So share your knowledge of and your passion for GIS with our young people. Teach them the tools to save our environment. And I'm going to quote Wangari Maathai's words, "They are our hope and our future." Thank you.
Congratulations, John.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
No, it doesn't matter. Wow. It doesn't matter at all. So here you are. On behalf of all of us, take care of yourself, John.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You can see why I love this guy. And his wife does, too. And his daughter does, too, and all of them. He's a totally creative genius.